Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal assistance organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. If you want to jot that down, that's 347-994-1149. And then you will press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question and you will be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose questions there. Today's show focuses on the innovative programming of Lighthouse Youth Services, an organization that is taking a comprehensive approach to assisting youth. Lighthouse is a multi-service agency operating 19 different programs as part of a continuum of care. Although today's show will concentrate on the programming available through Lighthouse's Juvenile Justice Division, all of our guests today work in that division. And our guests are Renee Hagen, who has worked at Lighthouse since 1987 and is currently the Juvenile Justice Division Director. She provides leadership in program design for residential, outpatient, and reentry programs working with juvenile offenders and is responsible for all staff training, regulatory compliance, and quality improvement efforts. She is a member of the Juvenile Justice Committee of the Ohio Association of Child Caring Agency and has received Lighthouse's Meritorious Service Award and Trustee Award for Leadership. She's a licensed social worker and earned her undergraduate degree from Wilmington College. Richard Gulley has worked at Lighthouse since 1998 and is currently the Program Director of Counseling Services. As such, he is responsible for the development and management of the treatment programs for low and moderate risk sex offenders. Rick previously worked at the Adolescent Wellness Center, Clark County Mental Health Services, and Daybreak Crisis Residential Shelter. He earned his undergraduate and graduate degree in mental health counseling from Wright University and has been certified by The Ohio State University as a sexual offender treatment specialist. And also joining us is Nathan Lynch, who has worked at Lighthouse for 9 years and is the program director for the Community Management Program, providing treatment and intensive therapeutic management services to juvenile offenders who are reintegrating into the community after residential treatment or incarceration. He is a licensed social worker, serves as an adjunct instructor at Miami University, and has been certified in the treatment, assessment, and management of juvenile sexual offenders through the Ohio State University. Nathan received his undergraduate degrees from Miami University, Oxford, Ohio, and his master's in social work from the Ohio State University. So I'd like to welcome all three of you to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So there's been a shift in thinking about treatment and rehabilitation of youth, where many states and localities are moving toward community and evidence-based programming and away from a model of mass incarceration of kids in secure facilities, often placed far away from their families and support systems. I know we have people listening around the country who are interested in Lighthouse's philosophy and want to hear about lessons learned and the impact of your programming that you offer to consider how something similar may be implemented in their own jurisdictions. So, Renee, maybe you can start us off by giving a very brief overview of Lighthouse Youth Services, and then we can concentrate on the programs under the Juvenile Justice Division that each of you work in.
Okay, Lauren. Lighthouse Youth Services is a large child, youth, and family-serving agency that's based primarily in Cincinnati, Ohio. Lighthouse began with a group home for girls in 1968, and since that time, we have grown to around 19 distinct programs across several different divisions that include a group home division, independent living, home-based services. We have foster care, our community school, Help Me Grow program, all targeting the most needs families, children, and youth. Today, of course, we're focusing primarily on our juvenile justice division. That work for you?
Sure. So why don't you tell us about Paint Creek?
Okay, Lighthouse Youth Center at Paint Creek was actually the first program in the Juvenile Justice Division for Lighthouse. Lighthouse at Paint Creek opened in 1986, and it was a residential treatment facility for adolescent boys who are 14 to 18 years of age. All of these boys have been adjudicated delinquent on felony-level offenses. Paint Creek is actually one of only two programs with Lighthouse that's not located in Cincinnati, and we're located in rural Bainbridge, Ohio, although we're serving kids from all over the state of Ohio. We contract primarily with the Ohio Department of Youth Services for kids who have been sent to these maximum security facilities, and then we work with them in our community-based facility if they meet the admission criteria and everyone feels like we're a good match for their needs. We also serve some local county courts as well, including Hamilton County and Montgomery County, our two largest counties we work with. The programs providing cognitive behavioral interventions, we're targeting criminogenic risk factors. Basically, we're trying to help youth identify thinking and behavioral patterns that that contribute to their delinquent behavior. We want to teach them necessary coping and pro-social skills, basically try to help them become more responsible, self-reliant community members. We have a non-public chartered school on site. Obviously, a lot of our kids come into the program, and they have significant deficits in education. So we want to work with them towards their high school diploma or GED. We try to engage families as much as possible. We're in a pretty rural area. We reach out to families and help provide them transportation and housing on site when possible. And we try to provide aftercare services in the areas we can, which is primarily Hamilton County and Montgomery County, which includes the programs that Nathan and Rick work with. So that's kind of an overview, a real quick overview of the Paint Creek facility. Rick, would you want to talk about youth counseling?
Sure. Lighthouse Youth Counseling Services is located in Dayton, Ohio, and we started providing services to adolescent sex offenders in late 1998 or 1999. We are a community-based program, and we're the only community-based program providing intensive services for kids who have been adjudicated on sexual offenses. We do provide services for both males and females between the ages of 12 and 18. We provide assessment services, treatment services, and transitional services for those returning to the community. We use a cognitive behavioral therapy relapse prevention format to help bring about change. The kids are in groups primarily, and our intensive kids come in on a daily basis, and our low-risk kids come in several times a week, and then we also provide individual services depending on what's needed at the time of the assessment. We work primarily with Montgomery County, but we do provide services to four other counties that request them, and a length of stay for kids in our program go from anywhere from 6 months to about 10 to 11 months.
And I guess I'll talk a little bit about the Lighthouse Community Management Program located in Hamilton County, Cincinnati. And this is the newer of the three programs, been operational for about 4 years now, but growing significantly, developing new programming this year in a partnership with Hamilton County Juvenile Court. And we're working with young men 17 to 21, so a little bit older. These young men are returning from correctional institutions, residential treatment facilities, and that could be in a child welfare system or Department of Youth Services institutions, and more recently, intensive aftercare programming specifically for the young men coming from Paint Creek, which allows Hamilton County juvenile courts to directly send kids to Paint Creek for short-term residential programming and then be able to return to Hamilton County with, a continuum of care and treatment that can be done in the community with their families. We kind of focus on kind of resiliency factors, the idea of teaching self-sufficiency and at times providing independent living, housing, and services, which fits with our age group and the needs, also with research indicating that some of the skills reduce recidivism. They're assigned a therapist and a case management that kind of work hand in hand with the idea of taking what they learned in a residential setting continuing that, but helping them to apply it to everyday life, apply it to relationships, apply it to forming a new role in the community, apply it to living with their families every day. With the idea, if they can do that, then we increase the odds for long-term recovery.
Mm-hmm. Well, working with youth can be really tough as well as rewarding. I would like to hear from each of you why you chose to work with youth.
I can tell you that.
Who wants to tackle that? You got it, Renee?
I got it first. I can tell you that I chose social services in general simply because I wanted to help people. When I was young and impressionable, I really had no clear direction about what that meant at the time. I landed at Lighthouse and at Paint Creek and in the juvenile justice field mainly because of geography, because of the program at Paint Creek had a position open, and I applied and was accepted, and I since then have grown to love it, and I've stayed at Lighthouse, and I've been here for 25 years because I really believe in what we're doing. I think we're doing good work with kids, and in turn, I think we're having a positive effect on communities. So that's how it worked for me.
Okay, I think I'll jump in here. I pretty much grew up in the system, so I've had a lot of contact with social workers and counselors and probation officers as I grew into adulthood. And when I got to thinking about a career, it seemed like a natural fit for me. So I decided to go to school after I left the military and get a degree in social work and mental health counseling. And I've focused on working with kids, I think primarily because I think I relate to them very easily. And I always felt that when I was a kid, gee, these folks didn't do it right, so I wanted to get into the field and try to do it right. So that was my motivation.
And probably a little bit more in a self-serving manner. I think early in college found out I was good at it. I was not good at other subjects, chemistry, math. Oh, I had such a difficult time, but was, you know, three chapters ahead in my psychology classes. And so in a part, it was something that was interesting, challenging, and I saw I had a skill. I could do it. The more I kind of looked into it and got into it, I saw it was difficult work, but it kind of fit, I thought, with my own views of how I saw others and the world around me and working to kind of find other people's potential and reflecting that back. So it just seemed an all-around good fit. And thinking back, that's kind of what I figured out is looking how I ended up here. And then with Lighthouse, the mission fit exactly with, I guess, my own personal mission and ideas about what I wanted to do.
Great. So, I mean, you've all mentioned the mission and then also this wide array of services and programs. Why do you think Lighthouse has been successful in assisting youth and juveniles?
Well, Lighthouse is a very mission-driven agency, and I mentioned earlier, you know, one of our strengths is that we are intentionally trying to serve those that are most in need. Our mission kind of states that, you know, our goal is to enhance dignity and well-being for everyone that we serve. And although the kids that we're serving have committed crimes against others, you know, they're harming other people, too many of these kids are also victims of themselves. They've been harmed, and now they're harming other people. And so as we began to work with them, we kind of realized that just because they've committed these crimes, it doesn't mean that they don't have needs and issues that could be addressed to help them become more healthier, help them make decisions that are better for them, help them achieve the success that they want to have, that we want them to have, that their communities want them to have. And in turn, they gain dignity. They become more responsible citizens. And it kind of helps to kind of break the cycle. I've always kind of seen it as bigger than just helping these individual kids. It's great to work with these kids. I love working with them. They have so much to offer that people oftentimes overlook. And I think once we tap into that piece where they can begin to feel some successes and to begin to feel dignity again, they want to succeed and they want to be a part of something better. What I think has been our most positive experience is the way that we continue to try to enhance our services around them. Paint Creek's been around for a long time, and we've had a long history of good outcomes with our kids. We're working with kids primarily. We've been working with kids primarily in a longer term situation. Our average length of stay over time has been like 14 to 15 months in some cases, because kids are actually sentenced to the Department of Youth Services. They actually call it adjudicated delinquent, but you know, they get a sentence with the Ohio Department of Youth Services, sometimes 2 and 3 year commitments, and you know, we work with them for a long time. Recently, with the addition of the community management program, we're able to begin to work with kids in the residential program away from their home communities for shorter periods of time, you know, helping the youth get stabilized, helping them get prepared to kind of continue to work their treatment in the community so that they can get back with their families, get back in their home communities, and finish their treatment with the support of a community management program where we're wrapping around services for them, helping them with their employability and their education, but also, you know, addressing their mental health issues, their substance abuse issues. So I think, you know, everything that we do, we try to stay true to this concept of we want those that we serve to become better and to become healthier human beings. And I think that we treat them with respect and dignity, and that contributes to their buy-in to what we're doing. So that's kind of my thinking about it. Nathan, did you?
If I could add to that, I think as far as kind of how we treat juveniles, I've always thought that they're very good at kind of seeing through and examining our motives. And, you know, they spend a lot of time often mistrusting, looking at the people who are trying to help them and trying to figure out what's going on with them, what's their motives. And I think, you know, as Renee mentioned about the importance of mission, and that Lighthouse, the mission is top-down, so it goes throughout the agency. So I like to think that, you know, when youth are working with us and they kind of, as they should, examine and look at us and try to figure out where we're coming from and what our motives might be, that they find that respect and they find that dignity. And it's good. We kind of check out from their standpoint, and they're more willing to work with us. I think on a broader level, Lighthouse is really good at kind of keeping their fingers on the pulse of the community's needs, and so they're keeping it relevant. And so they're not, you know, programs are developed in response to needs of families and communities, not trying to come up with a program and then try to go out and find people that need those services. And once that need is found, then I guess you got to figure out the best way to meet it. And to me, that's two ways that comes up. You know, the idea of just best practice, or what's the best way to provide care or to meet this need. And, you know, and also if the, more recently, even think of the context of the county or of the state, and what that environment, whether it's financial environment or attitudes of the community, or to look at that environment and what's the best way to meet those needs in that environment. And Lighthouse is very much a part of the community that they're in, and that helps them be able to do that very well.
I'd like to add to that if I could, Lauren.
Of course.
All righty. Why I think Lighthouse is successful, in my opinion, I think one of the things that really stands out for me since I've been with this organization is that I, and I think the rest of the personnel, we feel supported by Lighthouse as an agency. They hire good, qualified people, professionals, and they put us in positions that we want to be in and enjoy being in. And they provide the support so we don't have to worry about anything other than what we want to do and accomplish, and that is develop relationships with young people, help them learn, help them grow, and help them become productive citizens. One of the things that strikes me at Lighthouse when I go to meetings, because I really don't like going to meetings, but when I do go to meetings, it's a can-do attitude. I've been with organizations where we've talked about why we can't do something, and I don't find that at Lighthouse. It's not why can't we do it, it's what would it take to get the job done. And I think that really puts us in a position to be successful in working with juveniles.
Okay. Well, I think in sort of a related question, I mean, you're talking all three of you about dignity, well-being, and respect, which are very large concepts and kind of mean different things to different people. So what do you believe are like the most critical components, if you can break it down, to assisting youth in addressing their delinquency?
Who wants to go first?
How about you, Rick?
Okay, I'll go first. That breaks the tension. What I think is most important is an environment of respect. I think I look at kids and I see that they lack self-respect, and that developed long before they got to us, so that they need to understand that they are important, they are valuable, and they are respected. I think in developing that environment through those relationships, the next thing I want to do is get a little bit more technical and go into what we do in treatment, and we focus a lot on a youth thinking process, helping them understand, how did you make the decisions that you made? And when they're bad decisions, what process did you go through? And I think a lot of times kids respond with, well, I wasn't thinking, I don't know, that sort of a thing. Well, it's important for them to know that. But typically adolescents don't take the time to stop and say, gee, how was I thinking when I made that particular decision? The next thing I think is helping them build on their strengths and focusing on that. Versus trying to say, gee, you have all these weaknesses, because when you develop the strengths, the weaknesses seem to show improvement. So I think those are a few things that I think are very important components. If I put one out there, in my opinion, the most important thing that we do in helping kids is that at Lighthouse we take the time to develop a healthy relationship with them.
Lauren, one of the things that research is telling us is critical is that we're matching services and interventions to needs and risks. And so it's really important that we're targeting what they're calling, it's called criminogenic risk factors. And these are factors that are going to contribute to or increase the likelihood of them engaging in criminal behavior in the future. Now, risk factors include everything from things like Rick was talking about, you know, your thinking and your perceptions, your attitudes, your values about your criminal or irresponsible behavior. Things like, are you associating with negative or positive peer groups? You know, what kind of education or employment deficits do you have? Do you have substance abuse or dependency issues? You know, how are things going with the youth at home, as well as, you know, a mirage of mental health issues and just an overall void of having pro-social skills? And so cognitive behavioral programs are designed to kind of target these distortions, these destructive behavioral patterns, to teach new coping responses, life skills, social skills, self-sufficiency skills, as well as, you know, help them evaluate their thinking and their value systems. Our staff in all of our programs, you know, we spend a lot of time working with staff on helping them to, you know, teach kids on the skills that they want them to learn, but also to model the use of those skills so that kids can see that it can be done, and it can be done in a respectful way. We give them plenty of time to practice these things, and then we want to begin to create situations where they can learn to use these skills in real-life situations. So I think making sure that you're targeting and focusing on the issues that are important to each individual kid, and there's not some kind of blanket, all kids are going to get this kind of approach. You know, we need to look at each individual youth's risk factors, what their needs are, and make sure that we're addressing those at all levels of, you know, through a continuum of, you know, when they're first entering the system to when they're leaving the system.
Great.
And I think with that, I think with that, you, Renee did a great job of kind of laying out, and Rick, the skills and the intervention, and that's exactly on target. I would only add to that is we have to keep an eye on motivation. They have to be motivated in learning, but then also then wanting to apply and use the skills. And you know, one thing we've noticed with these young men coming back into the community after being away from the community, one of their main motivation and focus is relationships, which I don't think is really a whole lot different than other teenagers across the country. And so it's relationships with peers, with families, with, you know, how they're perceived and even with themselves and their communities. And they're very motivated. They're thinking about it all the time. they're putting a lot of energy and efforts into it all the time. And so we kind of roll with that motivation and apply all of those new skills, the cognitive behavioral techniques to those relationships. And so kind of going where they are and feeding off their motivation. You know, and I think with that, I think this is kind of a blanket statement, but it needs to be said. I think any effective intervention or treatment has to in some way convey or increase a sense of hope. A lot of these young men, given where their past, where they came from, where they're going back to, they may say, that sounds great. You know, boy, I'd love to be different. I'd love to make these changes, but I really don't have a lot of confidence it's going to change anything. Or I really still don't have a lot of hope for, you know, viewing myself past a couple years from now. So, you know, we have to, along with this, it's kind of more of an attitude or approach as we do these good interventions, is being able to convey, you know, confidence, hope, and eventually kind of convey that to the point where they can begin to maybe believe that and be motivated off of that themselves.
I would just echo with that, Nathan, that, you know, we are always getting feedback from our kids that kind of one of the things that is different is that they really do believe that staff care about them and that staff believe and they have the potential to achieve this. And so I agree when he says that, you know, no matter what your model is, if you don't have positive relationships with kids, they're not going to buy what you're selling. You know, they want to be able to trust you, and they want to, they need to know that they can trust you and believe in you, just like you want to believe that they can do it as well.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's very important.
So, I mean, you were talking about CBTs. When we hear a lot about evidence-based practice now, it's such a buzzword. So what are your thoughts about this? And there are a lot of community-based programs doing really good work who also are doing evidence-based, but there's a fear about that one-size-fits-all even turning to evidence-based, Renee, what you were talking about. So how can community-based programs be both innovative and outcome-driven? I know it's kind of a big question there, but I don't know if anyone has some thoughts about that. Anyone?
Rick, would you like to start?
Okay. I've got a fire truck going by my office here. I was trying to cover the phone.
Oh, it's okay.
Well, to me, evidence-based, I mean, it's just good common sense. I mean, there you don't redevelop the wheel. You look at what's out there, what's proven to be successful, and then you build and develop. I think one of the things we do at Lighthouse is we take these evidence-based ideas and we localize them to our communities and the culture with which we're working in. And I think that's important. I think the number one thing, Renee said it earlier, is to get these programs to work is the ability to develop relationships in order to implement the process. I think for me, innovation comes in when we are able to wrap the program around the individual and the family and not make them fit the program. So I think having the flexibility in developing service plans and goals and objectives and how do we know we're going to be successful. So we sort of develop a checklist of these things should happen for this individual and this family. I think being goal-driven or outcome-driven is exactly that, developing a service plan, one that is measurable and one that the individual client, the youth, the family can feel good about as they accomplish these goals and objectives and see themselves working toward sort of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel as it gets brighter as they begin to develop skills and ways to manage their life a lot better. In what we do in our community-based program is we have a combination of cognitive behavioral with relapse prevention, putting in and identifying what are the things, the thoughts, the feelings, the behaviors that were prevalent when you got into trouble, and how would you correct those? Because typically these kids are going to return to the environment they came in, whether they were in foster homes and they're going back home. They need to be able to have the strength. So this idea of relapse prevention also helps them meet their daily duties, meet their daily obligations, and it gives them a sort of a toolbox where they can look in and say, you know, gee, I practice this in treatment. I know how to address this. So there's a development of self-confidence and an improvement in self-esteem for their ability to face their world. So I think when you have something that's already been developed, such as CBT, relapse prevention, take it and mold it to your individual situation, because I think one treatment program in one area would and probably should look different than a treatment program in another area, but both could say we're using CBT. But it is, I think, specific to the culture and environment you're working within.
I think, we also have to acknowledge that these juveniles have, different typologies and, different mental health diagnoses. And, some have experienced past trauma. So that there's across the board, they come to us with varying degrees of treatment needs. And there's also best practices for all of those different issues. And so best practice is essential. You have to stay focused on that. You have to be knowledgeable of that. Working with our clients and our systems in itself creates a situations often there's a lot of confusion or misdirection. And, evidence-based practice kind of keeps you stable, keeps you, even keel, so to speak. But at the same time, there can be, as I think that Rick was referring to, it can be a danger of being too rigid and just kind of sticking to one approach and kind of being naive and thinking that this is going to work for everybody and everybody just needs to get on board and get involved in this intervention when that's not always the case.
When you think about evidence-based practices, it's kind of like your the tools you're going to use to live out your mission, and you hire the right people to put those tools into place. And so, over time, as you have the good mission, you have the good tools with the evidence-based practices, you hire the right people, over time, I think it kind of, one thing leads to the other. You develop consistency through the use of those evidence-based practices. The customers and the clients see that you have good outcomes with that, and then you're presented with even more opportunities for to do new and creative, innovative programming. If you think about, I always kind of equate this to like a medical model. If you're a patient, you're going to want to make sure that you're receiving the best possible care that you can get and have the greatest chance of recovery. For example, if you have cancer, you're not going to go to a general family practitioner. You want to seek out a specialist, someone that's trained to deal with this particular type of cancer. And the same is true with juvenile justice. You want to be able to deal with people who are going to best serve the client, which in turn best serves the community, which in turn, then creates better outcomes for everyone. It's the way of the world anymore. And so when you want to get funding from your customers or you want to get funding from grants, you have to be able to demonstrate that you are providing evidence-based practices and doing good work with providing outcomes. It's how you're going to get paid. And so it's not something that can be ignored anymore. And it's something that it's common sense. It's what we want to do. You want to get the best service for the best money for the best outcome.
Great, thanks. I just want to remind our callers, our listeners, that if they want to call in with a question, that phone number is 347-994-1149, and then you'll press the number 1 on your keypad, and you will be screened by Angela. We have less than half the time left, and I know we have a lot to get through. Why is it important to have a range of services to help youth?
Well, it's basically what I've kind of already mentioned is we want to make sure that we're targeting individual needs and not just having blanket responses to individual kids and individual situations. If you target one risk factor or one need without addressing the rest, it's really going to be an incomplete service. It's not going to be holistic for the kid. For example, we could provide kids to make sure they get their GED, their high school diploma, but if we don't address their kind of antisocial values or their criminal value system. We don't help them learn more pro-social skills. That education is not going to serve them. So you kind of have to address it at all different levels. And you also have to do it in a graduated way. And I think it's one of the things that we're most excited about right now is our partnership with the Hamilton County Court in this continuum that we're providing for the kids in their system. You know, they're very much interested in keeping kids out of these maximum security situations. You know, dealing with kids that can be treated effectively in the community without putting them in, you know, maximum security situations. And so instead of sending these moderate risk and even sometimes high risk youth to these maximum security facilities, they're saying, Paint Creek, how about if you provide this service, these cognitive behavioral best practice services to these youth in a short-term way. Let's get them out of their community. Let's stabilize them. And then we will work with you to bring them back into the community, to wrap services around them to ensure that they're going to have success. It's a great partnership where the probation officer, our community management staff, and the Paint Creek staff are all working together from the time a youth enters residential until they're off probation to make sure that there's a good continuum and that we're addressing all their needs at the different points in their treatment process. So, you can't just say, okay, we're going to send, and this is, it's a handicap. We're going to put you in treatment, but then we're not going to provide you any services when you come back to the community. We're going to put you in an institution, or we're going to put you in this residential treatment facility, which may be in our state or it may not even be in our state, and then expect them to have success when they return to the same communities and same environments that haven't really changed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With that, I think the idea of intensity of services and duration, we spoke a little bit of different types of services, but I also think the intensity and duration and the type have to meet, again, the need. A lot of times we're asking these youth to question themselves, to do difficult things. This is not easy work for them. And so what we're asking them to do, the service, one, has to really meet their needs, and two, it has to be logical. It has to make sense for them. And so I think if you can have a variety of services that can truly meet their needs, you're going to increase their compliance, increase the cooperative relationship that is key, especially in working with juvenile justice population. And that's a very difficult thing to work out, but it's well worth the attempt. As we've kind of laid out with these three programs, having different services that work with youth as they kind of move through the change process. In community we focus a lot on maintenance. And so how can you apply it? How can you maintain changes you've made? Where in residential, they're going to be focused on maybe more confrontation, more interrupting these cycles, and a lot of teaching, introducing new ways of thinking and skill building.
When I think of range of services for Lighthouse, we become very specific in what we do, which I think enhances the range of services that the organization offers. We are very specific in dealing with a social problem, and that is sexual behavior in America, which didn't come up overnight and has been with us for some time. But I think it has escalated due to technology. I think kids have so much more access to things like pornography. And there's some research out there that says if a kid looks at pornography, an adolescent male, he's likely to play that picture over in his mind thousands of times. That's a very definite influence on some decisions they might make. The other thing I think we look at is how we sell things to adolescents in this country. And we sell just about everything with sex. I would think back to a commercial Burger King had. It didn't last very long, so there must have been some public outcry of they had some lady swinging in a swing with a bikini on, and she's selling Whoppers. That's directed at the kids. So they are so much more bombarded with sexual behavior, sexual attitudes, sexual thoughts – And I don't think we've kept up with the technology in dealing with this. So this social problem has just continued to escalate as the years have gone by. I think one of the things in developing a range of services, Lighthouse looks at what are the needs of a community, and then they contact the community, in our case, the local juvenile court, to find out what is it that you would need and how can we help provide that to deal with some of the things that are going on in the way of kids' inappropriate sexual behavior. Majority of the kids that we work with, the overwhelming majority, we're dealing with kids who are sexually acting out within their families. And those kids are typically known to have more offenses and more victims than other types of offenders. In fact, right now, 100% of my kids, we're dealing with all incestuous types of inappropriate sexual behavior. So when you look at a range of services, I think programs or agencies such as Lighthouse do need to look at specific, more specific areas such as working with those who act out sexually in trying to provide services. I think it takes specialized personnel to be able to do that. I think it also takes a personnel with a very tough skin to be able to listen to stories that many people just shudder at when they hear about such things, and realize we're looking at kids, and kids make mistakes, and kids do make bad decisions. But we do know through the research that adolescents also have an outstanding success rate in not engaging in any other type of inappropriate sexual behavior once they complete treatment.
So thinking about that, and that we're dealing with kids and success, what type of juvenile justice reforms would you like to see take place?
Well, I can tell you that from my perspective over the last couple of years, there are some really good things going on in the state of Ohio already. Department of Youth Services has been really aggressive about deinstitutionalizing kids. I know that I think probably it was 3 or 4 years ago, there were almost 2,000 kids being incarcerated in maximum security facilities, and I just heard actually recently this week that they're down to near 700 kids in these maximum security situations. And instead what they're doing is really working with courts and communities to provide funding and options so that kids who have low and moderate needs can get their needs addressed in their communities. Again, leaving just the most serious offenders to the Ohio Department of Youth Services. Right now there is a House bill called House Bill 68, which has already passed the House of Representatives, now in the Senate, that mainly deal with reform in the adult system. But there is a piece in there that's specific to juvenile justice that I think that is really important for us as community members and, as constituents to think about. And it's about restoring judicial discretion when you're dealing with youthful offenders. As I mentioned earlier, you know, our kids, they're not unlike kids who are in the child welfare system. They happen to have the misfortune of landing in the juvenile justice system instead, but they present very much the same way. They have many of the same issues. But we have a law in place that mandates that judges sentence juveniles either to bind them over to the adult system and or give them mandatory sentences up as much as 3 years based on particular crimes. And it doesn't really allow the judge any discretion into hearing the story about the youth, to kind of evaluating the circumstances on a broader level. And what has happened is because of these specific laws, a significant number of youth, primarily youth of color, are being incarcerated unnecessarily when they could be treated in the community, staying with their families and working with community providers to, address their deficiencies with the families instead of sending them miles away from their family where they can't really be engaged with them. And, you know, I'm not a researcher. I'm a practitioner working with kids in this exact situation for a long time. But I can tell you that it does not make sense to say, you know, this kid is going to get better if we put him in a prison-like situation with a lot of other offenders. And I think we would spend a lot more positive energy on trying to rehabilitate them to become more productive members of our community. And it's also more financially prudent to do this. It's often, you know, more cost-effective to do local community-based treatment with better outcomes than sending them to costly maximum security institutions for extended periods of time. You know, Rick kind of alluded to some of the issues going on with sex offenders, and there's some issues with the sex offender registration laws as well that kind of impact what's going on and I think need reform. And Rick, would you talk about that some more?
Sure. You know, I like to talk about that. When it comes to registration, I mean, there is research coming out now that says it has absolutely no impact on recidivism whatsoever. It is new because registration, particularly for adolescents, hasn't been around that long. But they are looking into it. When I say they, organizations such as ATSA, the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, and looking at what registration accomplishes. If you can imagine being a teenager and you make a bad decision and you touch your brother or sister in your family inappropriately sexually, and you have to register for the rest of your life. That's a life sentence, and I think that is going to accomplish the opposite effect of what we want. So in the changes in the juvenile justice system, I would like to see the repeal of the Adam Walsh Act for adolescents. Kids are not little adults, and the way the Adam Walsh Act was developed in the state of Ohio, as I understand it, was primarily working toward adults, and at some point, adolescents were added into it. And when I looked at the law and had it interpreted several different ways by several different people, including the Attorney General, it was difficult as to how they had separated kids from adults. And I think that has to be looked at, because when we're dealing with adolescents, we're dealing with a brain that is not fully developed. They have not fully developed the skills to be able to take decisions of right and wrong and work them out in order to come up with the right decision to do the right thing. They are more impulsive typically, and they put less thinking or thought process into some of their decisions. So the Adam Walsh Act, to me, takes away an adolescent's ability to feel in control and have the power over their life, and that's one of the issues that is a part of sexual offending behavior, is that lack of control or feeling of powerlessness. So I would like to see change in our lawmakers taking a look at kids as kids, and I think listening to those in the field that work with kids and can help them understand what's the best way to deal with kids in this particular situation, because it is different than dealing with adults. I mean, we're dealing with adolescents, and the national statistics will tell us that anywhere from 90 to 96% success rate with adolescents who complete sex offender-specific treatment. Well, that's an outstanding success rate. The problem is, when you look at statistics, the adult sector will tell you every adult offender started as an adolescent. And you can read into that what you will, and usually that comes up negative. So I think laws like this, although I think the lawmakers meant well, I do not think it was well thought out, and to me that would be a change that I would look for in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that we had a whole show on Adam Walsh Act, and so if listeners are interested in learning more about that, that they can go into the archives that explores it and the history in Ohio. We only have about 10 minutes left, and I really wanted to hear, and maybe you can choose, each of you, some of the lessons you personally or professionally have learned, as well as, or a success story that you wanted to share to bring some of these kids' stories to life.
Well, I think for me, the biggest lesson that I've learned, I wouldn't say that I have a particular success story, because I think there have been a lot of them. But, you know, when I first started working with the juvenile offender, I had a lot of preconceived ideas about what a criminal offender or a criminal in general might look like or how they might act. And what I've come to find out after years and years of working with these kids is they're just kids. Didn't have the same opportunities that maybe you and I have had, you know, they've run into many more obstacles than you and I probably ever will. And they want the same things that we all want. They want to succeed, and they've just gotten to the place where, you know, they have less and less hope about their ability to do that. And I think we fail them when we as a community say, I'm sorry, we're going to treat you like an adult and, you know, lock you away. There is hope for them. They do want to get their education. They do want to have good jobs. They do want to become successful members of our society. And I think it's our responsibility to help these kids achieve that success. And anytime there is any youth that is able to overcome the obstacles and the bad choices that they've faced and had to deal with in their life so that they can become, you know, more responsible, productive citizens, I think it's a success. And I think it's a success for them, and I think it's a success for us as a community because we've helped them do that and we've welcomed them back into our communities. So, you know, for me, it's just think about that they are still kids. I know they're doing some bad things that are hurtful to people, but let's break this cycle and take the opportunity we have with teenagers and adolescents and children and give them hope for a better life.
I think one thing that I've become kind of excited about and have focused on with the community management program and have learned through a process is the idea of kind of trusting these kids' desire to improve, the idea that they want to be better, they want to find a new way. And, you know, kind of our tendency is that to act out of fear, to act out of our anxiety, to try to control or to push or direct. And that kind of indirectly says you don't want to change, you don't want things to be better for you, and so we're going to have to do this for you. And so trusting that they do want better things for themselves and then finding a way in the community to give them space to develop their own motivation, their own sense of control in doing that while supporting them and supervising them for community safety. And that's a challenge, and it also requires community involvement. The community has to be involved, has to take some responsibility in bringing these kids back to the community and supporting them. And that's very difficult, especially after these youth have hurt the community. They've created victims. But for successful reentry, for them to be successful, they need to feel supported and cared for by the community. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And so I think focusing on educating community and connecting youth with the community and fostering those relationships is key. And I think overall, as a field, we don't necessarily talk about that as much as we should.
I'd like to add a little bit to that, but I'd like to focus a little bit of a different area of challenges in doing the work we do and talk about secondary trauma. We as practitioners, we come to work each morning, and from the time we come in until the time we leave, we hear stories that are heart-wrenching, sad, and can bring about a wide range of emotion or feeling. That takes its toll on us as human beings. And I think all too often I've seen places, agencies, work situations that staff is not supported in dealing with the secondary trauma. We began to look at this about a year ago in what is our work doing to us as people. So we started a series of trainings that we do on a monthly basis to where we work on developing our skills, enhancing our skills. We also do debriefings almost on a daily basis, but formally twice a week, where we go through not only what's going on with the kids, but what's going on with us today, what's going on with us as we come in tomorrow. I think the secondary trauma is what results in burnout, and having watched people burn out, to take a look at why are they burning out, how do you support staff who deals with these situations, deals with these traumas in people's lives, and does it every day of the week. So we've done some things internally. Like I said, we've worked on training. We've gone to monthly staff lunches where, you know, we might bring in a comedy tape and just take an hour and not think about what we do and sort of develop relationships. We now do a number of team building activities, again, to support ourselves as we go through this work that we do. And I think looking at secondary trauma is very, very important for those of us that who are in this profession. And I think in some particular situations, such as the three of us, as we're talking about, we're dealing with what I consider the truly at-risk kids and families. And typically, they're those kids and families no one else really wanted to tackle. But I think that's one of the blessings of Lighthouse is that there is no problem too great. You show them a problem, and the can-do attitude comes out and says, okay, how do we do this? What is it that we need to do? So to me, that's one of our challenges, and I think that's a daily challenge that we all must face and be able to work through.
Well, we're at final comment time, so I don't know if all of you have something you wanted to end with. About 30 seconds each you have. Anything you want to share with listeners?
I guess I would just say anybody who is interested in kind of targeting this population would be to really spend time with others in your community and talk about what your community needs are. You know, key players like your courts, your child welfare departments, other providers in your area, and really try to define what it is that you need to target. Once you figure that out, define your mission. Do your research and find out what's considered best practice, and then really take a lot of time to hire the right people. You know, Rick kind of talked about the secondary trauma kind of after you get them hired, but there people get into the social services field for a lot of different reasons, and so you want to make sure that you're hiring people whose mission and agenda is consistent with what your mission and agenda is, and provide them with adequate training, adequate supervision, and support their efforts in working with your clients on a day-to-day basis.
It kind of matches a little bit what I said before, but I would just want to encourage nonprofits and providers to really seek out, collaborative relationships with the community. A lot of times the community is doing things to meet their needs, rather in the local churches or in small grassroots neighborhood communities or just groups of neighborhood people trying to make changes in their community. And instead of kind of developing two different opinions or just different opinions, different approaches, people putting efforts to make changes and to tackle some of these difficult issues, if just kind of bringing them together and to seek out a relationship.
The only thing I'd add to that is those working in the field, partner with your juvenile court systems. They're a valuable resource and anxious to work with you in order to address these problems.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank the three of you very much for being on Spotlight on Youth. It's been wonderful. And let our listeners know that there's two videos on Children's Law's website, which is childrenslawky.org. That feature Lighthouse. One is looking at the reforms in Ohio and the other at community-based program. They're called Putting a Face on Every Child, Ohio Juvenile Justice Reforms and Litigation and Advocacy, Keys to Creating an Effective Post-Disposition System. So also thank you, listeners, for tuning in today and to stay informed about upcoming shows. You can follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thanks again, Renee, Rick, and Nathan.
Thank you.
Thank you.